got a question. Greg, is that a shower curtain behind you?
Yeah, it actually is. I got it at the $1.25 store now.
Oh my God, that looks so freaking boss. I love that. That is
okay.
Great.
I mean, is that a shower curtain behind you?
No, it's an actual Marshall. And see, I can touch it.
Oh, got it. I could point to Big Ben.
You touch Big Ben.
Yeah, man. Oh,
that's... Can you go in that phone booth?
But give me, you know what? They smell like urine now.
You have to turn it on, too.
That's where the actual toilet is, inside the phone booth.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Non-working phone booths.
I think it's called the TARDIS over there in England.
Isn't that like a Scottish thing?
No, the TARDIS is Doctor Who's phone booth.
Oh.
It's a time-space thing.
I have somebody coming on the show in a couple of weeks, the end of March, who does a Doctor Who podcast.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I thought I'd end in London because that's where John and I's somewhat beginning started, in London.
Did you guys actually meet in London?
No, but John, you know, we were friends for a little while, and John called me up and said, "What are you on a Thursday?" And said, "What are you doing Saturday?" Said, "Nothing. What do you want to do?" And he goes, "Meet me in London." And
wait,
I said,
so you knew him before he called you up, right? He didn't just like some "What are you doing Saturday?"
We were acquaintances, friends through his band, but we weren't like brothers like we are now.
Right.
And I get a call on Thursday, and John said, "If you're not doing anything on Saturday, meet me in London." And I said, "How do I do that?" He goes, "Go get a passport in the city tomorrow and fly out the next day." And I flew out the next day, and John met me at the airport. And that's how.
So, John, you obviously knew how to do it before going into this. You had already been there.
Yeah, well, here's the deal. I played with this band called Infant for a while. And what it was is myself and like four guys from London and a drummer who was American, too. What happened is they came over. They didn't have a guitar player and a drummer. So myself and this guy, Scott, stepped in. And we played the clubs in Jersey for four nights a week for probably about a year. And the guys ended up going back, and one of the actually a good friend of mine from the band, Nick Dimes, was in London, and I had a chance to go over there. So I met him, and basically I met a lot of people over there. And then when I had a chance to go back, I told Greg, "Hey man, come on, get your stuff together and meet me in London on Saturday." And it was great. We had a great time, man. There was a lot of stuff. Greg, what was the time frame of that? What year was that? Because
it was 84. It was after the, you know, it was after the punk scene had died down, and we were into, if you remember, we were hanging out with Nick, and Nick had something to do with Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
I can't
remember what he had to do with it, but
what happened is he worked for this place called Instrument Hire Limited. And he actually took me to the studio where Frankie Goes to Hollywood rehearses. We went by the house that Uriah Heep rehearsed at. And there was like a great scene at that time in London. And there was all kinds of clubs. We were going to the Batcave and the Hippodrome, and it was just a great scene, you know? And we found a good place to stay, the Mitre House, which has kind of been Greg's home base now for the last like 30 years or more. And we have a lot of good friends that we're still in contact with that we met over there. So
that's, you guys have obviously stayed in touch and over the years have gone back and returned.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The Mitre House is, to me, it's a second home. To John, if he went back to the Miter House, it would probably be the same vibe for him because he still knows the people. He still knows the people over there. And yeah, it's been a while. We're looking to do it in October, and you are welcome, Mike. You're welcome to this experience.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You really quick, I just, before we get into all that, you mentioned your Uriah Heep, and it just like hit me, like what happened to Uriah Heep? Wasn't there a time in the 70s where, before all of the classic, the bands that we know as classic rock, quote unquote, became the powerhouses that they were, like in the early 70s, where there was a time when Uriah Heep was almost considered on the same level? Where they were almost, you know, where you heard more about them and you maybe got a sense that they were going to be bigger than they turned out to be. Is that just my reading of it, or is there some truth to that? Like, what happened to them?
I don't know, but all I know, their album Look at Yourself was fantastic. I love that album. And I saw them actually at the Capitol Theater in Passaic, and they kicked ass. They were a great band. There was a lot of around that time, there was a lot of really good music, you know.
I believe that, man, because a lot of people mention Uriah Heep. You hear them mentioned in a lot of conversations and interviews that go on in the 70s, right?
Yeah,
a lot of people that like Prague love Uriah Heep, you know. There's almost like that. I mean, there's that album Demons and Wizards, I think, man, that people speak very highly of. It's a group that I don't know too much about at all, man. To me, they seem like a footnote, you know, and I like to think that they're much more than that, you know, and that there's maybe something for me to discover in them. I don't know, maybe not. So I'm always asking people about that.
By the time I got to London, they had already were on the downswing, you know. They were like reforming and getting their stuff together again, but it was still, you know, a great experience for me because I always liked them. I thought they were a great band, you know. I mean, really, when I saw them, they put on a good show, and I think the Prague people like them because like something like July Morning, all right. That song goes on and on and on, you know, a lot of keyboards, a lot of things that, like, if you're a progressive guy, you'd be like, wow, this is great. You know, I mean, they were a good band. You can't take it away from them, you know? So a lot of good music out there.
Hey, John, when we were over there one time, the first time we took a walk, I remember we took a walk into a dingy part of the city. And you had a cassette tape in a package, and we went and dropped it off. You dropped it off through somebody's mailbox. Who was that? To this, I keep on meaning to ask. I think the person had something to do with the punk movement, didn't they?
No. Here's what happened. Before I went over there with you, I had met Lemmy from Motorhead. And we were at an after hours club, and in these clubs at the time, you would drink from like teacups because it was like illegal. Everything closed down at like I think it was 11 o'clock, and you'd go to this place and they'd serve you booze in teacups. I met Lemmy, and I was like, Lemmy, you know, I've got this band and we're trying to get somewhere, and he gave me the address of his manager, and then I sent over some tapes to him, but I guess we weren't heavy enough because I never heard back from him. But that's where we went. We went to Lemmy's management. What's that?
Oh, it was Lemmy's management. Okay.
Yeah. He was a great guy. I remember seeing him in LA a couple of times, you know, hanging out with him. Just a wonderful guy.
And Mike, I don't know if you ever heard this story, but the end when we were over there, every place we went, it seemed like John was a celebrity.
The Clem Burke story.
Yes.
Here's what
Nick Dimes, who John mentioned, he had us meet us at a club. Mm-hmm. And the club, a band called The Pretty Things back in the 60s was playing, and Nick was friends with the members of The Pretty Things. So John got up and was able to jam a couple of songs with the band. And after that, John said, we're going to Stringfellows. Stringfellows was a fairly new club, rich and famous, got in there. People like us were booted to the curb. Nick refused to go. John said, nope, we are going. There was a group of girls that we were talking to that were quite attractive. And John said, let's go to Stringfellows. And they said, no, that's a waste of time. And they left us. So we went to Stringfellows and we got in. They looked at John and they said, evening, Clem, how many? And John put up three fingers for me and Nick and John. We walked in and we were completely out of place.
Well,
when he said good evening, Clem, I mean, did you know what he said? Did you know what he was referring to, man? Or did you just go along with it? Did you say what? Who?
No. Now, here's the thing. You got to realize something. I mean, at the time, I played in various bands in the city. I knew everybody, all the doormen, and I would just walk in, you know. Believe it or not, if you were in a band and they knew you, they would let you come into the club for free. So I just have this attitude where I just, like, walk in. And when I went into Stringfellows, I was like, you know, okay, three. And I looked at him like, you don't know who I am?
I was just, you know, in the last episode I did, I was telling a story about Kate Bush and how my attitude has always been just jump the line, walk in. Like you have to know, you have to look like you know what you're doing, like you're supposed to be there. And
exactly,
most people will not question it, you know?
Oh, yeah. And you know what? At the time, I got to admit, you know, I had great hair. And in fact, my hair looked like I looked like Clem Burke a little bit, you know, same round face, you know, a little spiky hair, kind of like almost like a mullet, and about the same size as him. He was from New Jersey too, so we both sounded the same. So I could see the mistaking, but I wasn't going to tell him, hey, you made a mistake. We need to pay to get in. So it was great. It was a fun time.
Right. So, what I was asking, like, had you already been like mistaken for Clem Burke, or was it something new? Did he just say Clem and you knew it was, you know, he meant Clem Burke, or was it just kind of like, oh, or just go with it? I don't know what he said, but I'm in.
No, there was a couple of other times you were mistaken for Clem Burke when I was over there.
He was probably over there with Blondie or something. That's
nice.
You know, I don't know. You know what? Like I said, Mike, I just used to walk into clubs and nobody ever questioned me. So it was one of those things. I mean, we really, in New York, I could get in anywhere without a problem.
Well, Mike, I never was able to walk into clubs and they'd always boot me out of the clubs. So my memory of those things of just being able to walk into clubs is pretty, pretty strong because it was so unusual.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking with Greg and John Kay, Rock Under Fire podcast. I found these guys in a I guess not quite a club, but I found you guys in a bar, right?
Yeah.
I found these guys in a bar, in a karaoke bar, or more accurate, a bar that has karaoke, not really a karaoke bar.
Oh, but, man.
These guys are I've often plugged my most recent book on this podcast, The Locker Notes. And it's a novel that's based on growing up in the suburbs of central New Jersey in the 1970s. And it was music and movies and sports and politics and world news events, all seen through the eyes of a little child. And this child would sit up in his bed late at night, looking out the window, hearing the loud music of parties going on in the neighborhood, in the surrounding houses, through all hours of the night. Little did he know it was Greg. He'd see these dark, shadowy figures of the older bad kids walking the streets outside, headed up to the block, the end of the block, the point where he could no longer see past, where at the top of the block was met by a fence and all of these scary looking trees behind the fence. And what was beyond that fence was always a mystery to the kid. But he knew that those kids were always going back there into the unknown. those older kids, Greg, that was your age group, man. And maybe you were hanging out with some of them, because that kid, obviously, you know, some of the, you know, fiction is great, because you have like fictional license where you can do what you want with, you know, true stories and kind of stretch them and compartmentalize them and take out pieces and put them into other places that need pieces. Right. So
I think you're right, man. I think just our minds and our memory back from those days does that itself.
And what I later found out was that you grew up almost directly behind me. And
yeah, we used to sleigh board down that little hill right behind your house.
And John, you were from Queens originally?
Yeah. Yeah, I was from Queens, and then when my parents moved here, I moved with them. So
here, just for our, you know, listeners, because we don't need anybody out there stalking us. So here is in Central Jersey.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
exactly. Which the fictional town of Oakwoods, New Jersey, as you can tell that, you know, Greg knows, Greg gets the reference, Oakwoods, like the Oak Woods, which there's very little of the Oak Woods left because it's a big housing development now.
Yes.
Just talking to you guys at our mutual watering hole, you guys did. I mean, I always say I would much rather have been born in 1960 and have graduated high school in 1978 as opposed to 88, man, because you guys were right in the fucking core.
You know, right, the nucleus, man. I gotta admit something, Mike. You know, COVID ruined everything. All right. But even before COVID, it was just, I don't know, it's like boring compared to how it was.
Well, that's what I'm referring specifically to the 1970s. And you know, one of the first conversations you and me ever had, John. You were telling me you saw Queen in 1974 or something like that, man.
I saw them at the Eurus Theater with Mott the Hoople with Ariel Bender playing
and
guitar.
And, man, those are legendary shows, man.
Yeah.
You know, that's.
And that was the second time I saw Hoople. The first time I saw Hoople was at the Felt Forum with the New York Dolls.
And that was an amazing show.
Amazing. Wow. Yeah, but Queen was funny. I mean, they almost looked scared when I saw them. And they were doing some bits from their second album. And they were just phenomenal. At that point, I knew these guys were going to be big, you know. And it was just a wonderful experience to see bands when they start out and see what they progressed to.
So they were touring their second album. Now, was it their show or were they opening for Mott?
They were opening for Mott the Hoople.
Wow.
And Mott had just reformed with Ariel Bender playing guitar instead of, I forget his name. Their other guitar player went
Mick
to
Ralphs.
Mick Ralphs, who I loved as a guitar player. But he ended up starting a band. What the heck's the name of it? Anyway, he started another band. It was still a good show. Ariel Bender was a great guitar player. And Ian Hunter was fantastic, a legend. He's still around. I think he's got a new album out, too.
So you were going, you had tickets to this show. You were going, were you going to see Mott or had you already like known about Queen? Did you see this show and say, who was this band? Who's this new band, Queen? Or were you aware of them at that point?
I was a fan. And ever since the opening of Keep Yourself Alive, I was a fan of those guys, and I've never wavered. Always loved them. The thing is, when I first heard Queen, they were so new, I didn't even know how to describe them. I was telling my friends, you got to hear this band. They're as heavy as Led Zeppelin, but their vocals are like Yes. And that's how I kind of thought of them until they developed their own a persona, you know, or I got to know them a little better, but just a fantastic band, just a great experience.
Yeah, the Queen sound has always been in it, so like unique in the sense that there's no precedence to their sound, or
exactly.
Before or after, nothing sounds like Queen. They've got that airtight, compressed sound that almost sounds like it could just like burst, like it's like compressed into the size of like a, I don't know, like just like the Big Bang itself, man. Like it could just burst at any sound at any time. And that's what it sounds like. It just sounds like, I don't know. I don't know if it's Brian May, if it's mm-hmm. the drums, if it's just everything together, man. Sometimes I think it's Roger Taylor, but sometimes I'll listen to, you know, that unique guitar sound that Brian May got out of his amps. And I, from what I understand, he's using it's just simply like a Vox.
AC-30s or something.
AC-30, right? Whatever they did, man, it worked.
Speaking about Brian May, if you want to, you know, Queen is something that, you know, I've always respected the past, but always want to hear something new. Always looking for something new, and sadly, I can't find anything new. Recently, I listened to the song "March of the Black Queen" from the second album by Queen. Totally brought back an amazing respect, more than I think I've ever had for Queen. So if you guys haven't heard that song in a while, go back and take a listen to March of the Black Queen. That is amazing. It's mind-blowing, the time when they did that song and everything going on in it.
They were born fully formed, man. They didn't evolve. Like they evolved, man, but you know how most bands have their derivative, in a sense that you can hear their influences in the first couple albums, and they become themselves at some point between the third and fifth album, right? Queen mm-hmm. seems to have been born fully formed. Like everything about Queen, they presented to us right at the outset, you know? They just got better and better at it, right?
Yeah, they were pros. I mean, they didn't just like hatch and, you know, we're here. I mean, they were playing the scene over there for quite a while in different bands, you know? I mean, I think if you watch the movie, the last one to join the band, what was it? Was it Freddie Mercury or the bass player? But those guys played together for a long time. Roger Taylor and the guitar player, Brian May, were together for a long time, you know? So they became more than the sum of their parts, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I almost want to say they were rootless, where you don't so much as hear, like the first two Zeppelin albums, you hear blues, you know, you hear all of the artists that they drew from. You don't mm-hmm. so much, you don't hear that with Queen. You hear Queen when you hear the first album, man. You know, there's not a big difference between the first two or three albums, man. Like you like the first two albums sound a little similar. Keep Yourself Alive could have been on Sheer Heart Attack, you know. It wasn't until they started getting, you know, like Night at the Opera, they kind of started branching out and incorporating like cabaret stuff, man, and you know, My Melancholy Blues and Leroy Brown with it was a song off of Sheer Heart Attack. I the name escapes me at the moment, but you know what I'm talking about. They just kind of they didn't sit still in terms of, like, you know, everything wasn't just 4/4 time, you know, 4 on the floor rock. Yeah.
The other thing I think that made them unique is Freddie Mercury, because there was no singer that really had his kind of like flamboyant theatrical background. You know, I mean, he grew up on those Indian movies too. You know, where they're singing and dancing the whole time and just, you know, very...
Right, yeah.
He was kind of Broadway in a sense, you know?
Yeah, vaudeville almost. And
exactly.
So there was definitely that element. I mean, that I have to attribute almost solely to Freddie Mercury, man.
Oh,
he
yeah.
Was a showman, and he was the... it's just like the decadence of the 70s, man. We owe a lot to Freddie Mercury single-handedly, man.
Well, let me ask you a question. What do you think of Adam Lambert?
I can't say I've really listened much to them or even, you know, been exposed to much Queen with him in it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how well he does all of the songs. I've heard him do some of them and he does them very well. And I've gotten past that part of my characteristics that says, oh, that's sacrilege. You know, how dare they try to carry on without Freddie, or how dare the Doors try to tour without Jim Morrison, and that's sacrilege and fuck that. You know, yeah, I passed through that, man. We get old. We're at the end of the line. Let these people play their music, man. God bless them. More power to them. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how Adam Lambert is, but if it works for them, sure, man.
I can't. You guys are probably a lot more liberal thinking on that versus me. I can't. I watch it. It's, you know, I see the clips. It's a good show. I just can't. I can't do Adam Lambert. Can't do it. I think there's so many other. Paul Rodgers. I was blown away by the clips of Paul Rodgers singing with Queen. He did an amazing job. George Michael did an amazing job. Adam Lambert, to me, is... I don't know. It just, for me, he's too he's not Freddie. You know, he should be doing his own thing.
But the problem with, I didn't have a problem with Adam Lambert because I haven't seen enough or heard enough, but what was very apparent is that there was correct me if I'm wrong, Greg, what you're trying to say is there was like an edginess, a rawness to Freddie Mercury, as there was to most of the lead singers of the 70s, man, that there isn't, we don't get with anybody of this generation of singers. I don't that rawness in anybody of this generation. It's too smooth. You know what I mean?
You're right. Because
he's a proper singer where Freddie Mercury can sing, but he was creating.
Paul Rodgers sat in.
Adam Lambert's interpreting.
Paul Rodgers did his own interpretation of Queen when he sang with him.
Right, but Paul Rodgers is also Paul Rodgers.
Right, exactly. But he was amazing. You know, he was amazing doing it, even though he didn't have the, even though his range was different than Freddie's, he really did justice to those tunes. And then that tribute to Freddie when George Michael did Somebody to Love blew me away.
Yeah, let me tell you something. George Michael, I thought, was absolutely brilliant in Somebody to Love. He was brilliant. But as far as Adam Lambert, Amber goes back, can't even talk anymore. I thought that from what I saw of him, I think he did an excellent job. And you know what? He's not trying to be Freddie.
Right.
And that's what I like about it. And you're absolutely right. Let the guys play their songs.
That's why I have no problem with it.
Yeah. And you know what? It made Adam Lambert bigger and it made Queen bigger.
20 years ago, I would have said it's sacrilege.
Exactly. But I think enough time has gone by that the people deserve to hear these songs, even if it's Adam Lambert singing them and not Freddie.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, it's good music, and God bless him for still playing.
And I, to your point, man, with George Michael was already George Michael when he did that. So he has a sense of authenticity about George Michael. I was a fan of his music, but he was the real deal, man. He wasn't. Definitely. We don't know what Adam Lambert sounds like. What does we know that Adam Lambert can interpret everybody else's music? But what does Adam Lambert sound like? What is his persona? What are the characteristics in his singing as an artist? You know, who is he? Is he a shell that can absorb everything and take on all these other personas? I don't, I can respect that to a certain degree, but, maybe this is getting closer to what Greg was pinpointing at, Paul Rodgers was Paul Rodgers. He was established. He had his own signature. George Michael had his own signature. I don't know what Adam Lambert's signature is or if he even has one. You know, he's very good at what he does. He's great at what he does.
I think you hit the nail on the head. Sorry to interrupt, but I think you hit the nail on the head. Adam Lambert, I think, interprets the stuff well. I don't know enough about his catalog or listen to him outside of what he does with Queen. So I can't judge. But he, from my mind and from people that I know that have seen him and the clips that I've seen, he does a good job on that stuff, you know?
Greg, you saw Queen a few years later with Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, that was amazing. You pulled up that ad for that show.
I found the original ad for Greg's concert, man. I got to look up yours, John, because I'm like constantly in the newspaper archives going.
Yeah, but you know what? I was at that show too, the one with Thin Lizzy.
All right, man. That was Day at the Races tour.
It was wow. That was great.
Thin Lizzy was an amazing band. That was one band that, you know, I probably wish if I had to go back in time, I would have given a lot more time to, because those guys were an amazing band.
It took me a long time to come around to them.
Yeah.
I saw a very abbreviated version of Thin Lizzy open for Judas Priest many years later, but it wasn't the real thing. You know, it was just like, I think they had like one original member left.
Yeah, I remember that project. Did they call themselves Thin Lizzy? I don't think
they called themselves. They did. It was called Thin Lizzy, man. Yeah.
You mean like Foreigner? Except Mick Jones goes up and he doesn't even play anymore. There's no original.
This is the future. This is the future of rock, man. It's kind of like what classical music has become. Like we can still hear Mozart and Beethoven and Bach, but it's different people playing it and arranging it. You know, it's going to be just different cover bands in the future, covering the Beatles and covering Led Zeppelin. And you could go see a Led Zeppelin show with some other band playing, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of that, I'm waiting for Kiss to go on tour again with no original members.
They say it's possible. I don't know.
Yeah. Why not? You know, they've got a money machine, you know?
There are people that'll do it. That'll buy the tickets, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
That opens up another conversation, John. That might, you know, somebody, four new members of KISS might actually be real. What was both you two as guitar players, what do you feel about these bands touring and using tons of backing tracks? And they're not using backing tracks because what they did in the studio is too complicated to play live. They're using backing tracks because they can't do it anymore as performers. They can't sing the stuff anymore, so they got to have a backup. So what's your feeling if $50, $100 for a concert
first, John.
Yeah, Greg, to your commentary there, I saw Kiss recently, and you know they're still doing it, but Gene Simmons looked like Bela Lugosi, and Paul Stanley would stop singing and you would hear him still singing. So you know they're I give him credit for still trying to make money doing this, but I think they're not going to be able to keep it up much longer.
I think the backing tracks. See, I'm past that too. At this point, like I'm past like, there's a lot of, I'm looking at my screen right now. I'm like totally like, I'm glad I don't have to do video on this podcast. I'm looking.
You're totally green, Mike.
That is so weird.
I was going to say the video looks pretty cool. You
I'm seeing all three of us in my image though. Now in my picture, I just saw Greg upside down. Anyway, so, everybody, not I don't say everybody, a lot of acts are doing it. A lot of acts are just like playing the tracks. I mean, if you're at the tail end of your career, you got to do what you got to do. Lowering the key a full step or a half step no longer works. Sometimes you just have to play the tracks. I don't know. But something that Greg said before about, or when you said that they were all talking about, you know, Kiss with no original members. I have a crazy idea that they should follow this, man, that if it works, which I don't think it will, but if somehow it ends up, people end up buying into it, they should just retrace Kiss's career and start out and appear as this new band called Kiss and they re-record the first, the debut album, put it out and recreate the first tour, then recreate the second tour. Then like in their third year, go out with the Dress to Kill stage set and recreate the costumes and recreate Kiss over a period of years in real time, the same way it unfolded in the 70s.
Well, you know what? You just basically what you just said was Beatlemania.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's I could see them doing something like, all right, we're going to have Kiss in Las Vegas for the next 6 weeks. And it's just going to be like, a cover band that they sponsor, and do the same thing, changing costumes and sets.
Right, but I don't mean during the course of one show. I mean like over a period of years. Like this year, the band is going to do the first album and it's going to be like they're going to recreate Kiss in 1974. Next year, the band is going to be Kiss in 1975. 2 years from now, it's going to be Kiss in 1976. And you're going to witness the evolution of Kiss in real time the way our generation did.
It's
a long commitment. And a lot of
new generation, though, rock and roll seems to be dead. So could something like that ever even happen? Even if it was a brand new band, doing something new, could there be an evolution for a brand new band?
Well, I'm thinking hypothetically, because I think you're right. I don't know that. I mean, I think rock will exist, right? It does exist. It's on the fringes, right? It's no longer part of the cultural zeitgeist. It's no longer informing what people wear and how people talk and act. And it's not, reflecting the state of the world like the way it once did, right? 12, 13, 14-year-old middle school kids don't want to be rock stars anymore. Nobody's flocking to play guitar anymore. It's very rare that, if you tell me, like my nephew, he's 8, he wants to play guitar. That's great. If you're a kid that's lucky enough to have a parent or a grandparent that loves rock music and is turning you on to rock music, great. But I think the most part, it's not happening, man.
Right. Think about you guys growing up. When I grew up at 5, I can remember under the Christmas tree when I was 5 years old, there was a drum set. So from 5, I was exposed to music through drums, progressed into guitar, progressed into bass. I'm sure the same thing happened with you guys. Is that happening in today's youth?
No.
Our parents going out they're buying them an Atari, whatever it is.
It can't. Because the cultural zeitgeist, and I look at that word, man, which I guess is was coined like over 100 years ago, man, in the 19th century, man. But it's just a reflection of the times, man. It's the state of pop culture, man. And kids are playing video games. Kids are listening to rap. They wanted to, like, the rap stars are the new rock stars, And I think there is some truth to that because they're influencing. I mean, like, there was a time, I guess, before all of our time, before we were all born, man, where they said rock was for the young, made by the young, for the young. And, nobody wanted to be making music in their 30s because it was going to be embarrassing because you were old at 30, right? So Mick Jagger said, I don't want to be playing Satisfaction at the age of 40. And supposedly this comment that's attributed to Dylan, don't trust anybody over 30. And Elvis at the age of 32 doing his comeback special, I think he was 32 or 35 or something, but he was young. And he's up there acting old. He's embarrassed to be up there, because he really did think he was old, And there's none of that anymore, man. Like, these guys were the ones that wrote the story. And I think that that story is kind of largely passed now because kids are listening to Justin Bieber.
Speaking of that, you take a song like Bohemian Rhapsody, because we were talking about Queen. To me, that is so iconic. That's almost like a national anthem. Like everyone, every age should know that song or has heard that song. So at work a couple of weeks ago, I did an experiment. There's a couple of guys that I work with that are probably born in 2000, 2001, played Bohemian Rhapsody. They never heard the song. It was the first time they heard the song. It blew me away. I couldn't believe it.
See, I envy that, man, to be able to hear Bohemian Rhapsody for the first time. You know what I mean? I'm jealous of people that are hearing it for the first time.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, they weren't excited.
It must sound totally like alien to them, like or foreign or something. Like I can imagine, or I can't imagine, like the stuff that we love, man, that we grew up on. That just sounds totally like, I don't know what it sounds like to a kid that's 10 today.
Even Nirvana, you know, from the 90s. To me, the 90s, I mean, that was a great era for me for music. I can't believe people still don't know who Nirvana was or haven't heard their music, you know, that are born in, you know, early 2000s.
Think about it this way. So you guys were born in the 60s, I take it?
Yeah.
And I was born in the 70s. I was born in 1970. So when you guys are growing up, you guys are 10 years old. I'm not going to ask you guys to give your age, but I'm assuming you guys are 10 years old some point in the late 60s, early 70s, right? So jump in if I'm wrong or if you need to correct me at some point. I'm just speculating here. When you guys are 10 years old, 12 years old, 15 years old, and you think back to, and you hear swing music from the 40s or Frank Sinatra or Bing Crosby, that music's already 20, 30 years old. Did you guys take that music seriously? Did you think like, that's my grandparents' music. Oh, that sounds funny. Did you laugh at it? Did you make fun of it? Did you think like, you know, who listens to that? Our grandparents listen to that. Maybe as you got older, you learned to respect it and say, hey, that was actually good stuff. It was of its time. It represented an era, not mine, but theirs, right? So, I mean, I would imagine that something like Bohemian Rhapsody sounds like swing music sounded to us. You know, it sounds totally foreign. It sounds old. It's grandparents' music. I don't know. I mean, that's the way I try to rationalize it that way, where rather than like, I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's the way I try to logic it out and tell myself that's how kids are perceiving the music of our generation.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. It's hard for me because my parents, oddly enough, they never really listened to music in the house. They exposed me to music where they'd come home with Beatle records for me, but they didn't listen to music. So my music growing up was WABC AM. So, you know, you heard a lot of those, you know, pop songs, you know, on the radio. And then one day my dad brought in Black Sabbath's first album. And I put that on. I think, I don't know how old I was. I didn't know what to make of it, but I just remember it was a dark room I was listening to it in, and it was dark music. But I was exposed that way. So I wasn't exposed to anything really in the 50s or 40s, except when Happy Days became popular on TV. That was my real experience going back to hearing 50s music.
Bill Haley, right? That was the original song of Happy Days, Rock Around the Clock.
You know, it didn't do anything for me. But I knew the songs. I knew the songs, but never listened to, never really got into the genres.
John, when you were a kid, what were you listening to? Like, what music were you exposed to? Like, not necessarily that you listened to by choice, but was there music playing in your house growing up?
Mike, I tell you something. The stuff that I grew up with was Motown. I absolutely loved that stuff. And it was just weird because it wasn't really, you know, what a kid would be listening to. Actually, they'd be listening to a lot of the stuff on ABC, but I just really dug that sound, you know, always. And I also listened to, my parents played, you know, Middle Eastern music and So I had like a really weird kind of background, but I just liked all kinds of music, and even big band stuff that I was exposed to at the time. I really liked that too. I pretty much like everything except country and Western. And then as I got older, I started appreciating that. But that was the one form of music that I just, when I was growing up, I was just like, ah, this sucks. You know, I mean, I grew up in the city and, you know, nobody was listening to that. Everybody was listening to, you know, Motown or whatever, you know, but cowboy music was not a thing, you know.
Motown's not a bad musical education, man.
Oh, God, you know? it was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
The music, it's crazy because the music that's nearest and dearest to me, man, when all is said and done, man, and all of my favorite bands and artists, man, you know, my favorite bands are the Beatles and the Stones and REM. Those are my three favorite bands ever. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, The Who, and just a lot of the classic, you know, the British Invasion bands.
Sure.
And artists, Bob Dylan, Patti Smith, Springsteen, you know, I have a lot of favorite artists, Bowie. Okay. But when all is said and done, man, the music that's nearest and dearest to me is the music that was on ABC, man, and later CBS, the stuff that the pop songs of my childhood, man. So not quite Motown, but I love the Philly soul, the stuff like mm-hmm. the Stylistics and the Spinners, man, and the Delphonics. And that stuff was always on the radio when I was a kid, man. Any 70s pop, some of it is really, really horrible, like really cheesy, man. But you know, I'm a sucker for that stuff, man. I'm a sucker for Dreamweaver, man. I'm a sucker for 10cc, you know, all this stuff that makes me feel 5 years old again, man. You know,
hey, have you ever reached out to those artists to see if you could get them on the podcast? You know, because at this
podcast,
point,
no.
You know, because at this point, it might be an easier thing to do than you think, because, you know, they could be retired. They could just be happy to talk to somebody that admired their music.
I noticed that a lot of artists, man, that didn't have that trajectory of constant success over the years, like when anybody wants to talk to them, you know, I've noticed that, man. But yeah, I mean, this podcast, the days are numbered, man. I've got like 8 episodes left. So I really, I'm just, this is done. This one's done. If I don't know if I'm ever going to do anything again, but it's definitely not going to be under the Rock Under Fire banner, you know, maybe we should look some of these people up.
Well, I still want to talk to you about writing a book.
That's going to lead into the topic that I wanted to talk to you about, and I want to see these things. Are you actually going to hold these up to the camera?
Can you see it?
I see it, but the picture is actually disappearing. It's actually vanishing.
Yeah.
It's melting into your back screen.
That's probably what it is. Yep.
Yeah. So you have kind of a unique the extensive traveling that you guys have done across the Atlantic over the years, right? Mm-hmm. It's resulted in a pretty unique collection of, I guess, what we can call personal rock and roll memorabilia in these rail tickets you have.
Yeah, John calls it. John calls them death tickets.
Death tickets. All right, so let's get into this, because I wanna hear about this. I think it's a very cool idea that you have. I think it would make a great book. From what you're telling me about it, I'm just like, because I haven't actually seen these. I'm imagining them.
Saturday, I'll bring out if you're around. Yeah, so I flew back from England. I think it was on a Saturday, got in, and Vintage Vinyl In Vintage Vinyl in Ford's was doing a show, and there was a British band playing there. So I went up and saw them, and they were really good. And it turned out they were from Manchester. They just flew over from Manchester, England. I had just flew in from Manchester and didn't have anything to get signed. And in my wallet, I still had a British Rail ticket from Manchester. So I pulled it out and asked them if they'd signed the rail ticket. So I thought, you know what? That's really a cool idea. You know, no, how unique is that? You know, so I decided, you know what? Let me go back in time. Let me see if I could contact people that I've met in the past. Never asked them for anything. And let me see through friends like, you know, John and Russ, people that have connections in the music industry, who I might be able to connect with and get rail tickets signed. So, it turned into a huge collection, which to me is, you know, one of a kind and unique. And then in talking to you, because you as a writer, thinking, how cool would that be to write this real but fictional book and interview English artists about their memories of riding the rail in England, because in England, the rail is how they travel. So
much of Europe is, right? Much of, you're talking about Europe itself.
You know, like imagine getting clapped in or Page to sit down with you and sign a rail ticket and talk about their time on the British Rail. And I really think that it would, you know, it'd be a great idea to put into a book. But the rail tickets themselves, you know, I got about 100 of them signed now. So, you know, to me, it's, you know, I could part with a lot of things, but that's a one of a kind for me. John calls it the death ticket, because it seems like whoever signs the ticket dies, according to John.
Is that what started happening?
No, you know what happened, Mike? It's funny. It's like you hear about a pop star dying, right? And all of a sudden, I look on Facebook and I see Greg, and he's got a rail ticket with their name on it. I'm like, oh my God, that happened 2 or 3 times. After that, I'm like, there's no way I'm ever going to sign one of those things for you, Greg. So it was just funny. So Greg, who's the last guy that died that you have assigned one of those rail tickets for?
Phew, I don't know. you know what? I don't want to think about it.
Okay,
but I'll have you sign one Saturday.
Wasn't Eddie Van Halen one of them?
Yeah, I got him. Yes, he's one of them.
He's one of the people you killed, or is he one of the ones?
I think John put an evil spell on that.
You guys are lucky. You guys are lucky. I don't have that big of an audience, because anybody listening to this, man, they're going to be very hesitant to sign your tickets in the future.
Well, you know what? Oh. It's not that they signed them and then they died. It's just that he's got so many of them. Every time something happened, he would call a ticket up with their name on it, and I'd be like, oh my God, you know. So it was just like a really funny coincidence.
There was a period here, like, cut in really quick. Hold that point. There was a period where we were calling this the death cast, because every time we would do an episode, the next day somebody would die. And because we're a bi-weekly podcast, we didn't get to talk about it until 2 weeks after the fact. And then we would record, release the episode, and then the next week somebody else would die. This was in that period between 2016 and 2018 when everybody was dying. All right. Go ahead, man.
Yeah. So anyway, it's just nothing but a coincidence.
Yeah, that's why, like, when we're sitting there drinking beers, Mike, if you ever hear I don't know, in the past, if you remember hearing me say to John, hey, would you sign a rail ticket, you know, because he's being a jerk and he's pissing everyone off, so I asked him to sign a rail ticket.
did anybody ever give you any problems, like, that you approached where, you know, can you sign this? And
yeah, actually, like, John, you were with me, George Harrison's son.
Uh-huh.
Remember?
Yeah.
He wouldn't sign it. Maybe he knew. I don't know. Yeah, no, he wouldn't sign it.
It turned out his dad signed one, so. You killed George Harrison, Greg.
Yeah, he would.
Yesterday was his birthday too.
David Coverdale
would have been 80, Greg.
Yeah, Coverdale. David Coverdale wouldn't sign it. I remember George Harrison. So what's his name? Donnie wouldn't sign one. Just trying to think who else. Those are two that I remember.
Well, maybe after this podcast goes viral, they'll say, "Hey, man, Greg, I'll sign."
Greg is coming your way in October.
Yep.
The 2023 tour.
Rail tickets.
I'm going to Berlin.
Oh, wow.
I said, like, I want to go to Berlin, right? And you guys were like, you guys, this was a couple months back. John, I think it was John that said it. You're like, man, we're going to go London or Manchester or whatever. I was like, no, I want to go to Berlin. And you're like, well, Berlin's not in the UK, Mike. I'm like, I know that, John, but I still want to fucking go to Berlin.
All major cities now, you know, maybe European cities, New York City, it's just unaffordable. I don't know how people, you know, do it. I don't know how people live in the city. Like, John, you have a lot more experience in New York City than I do. I don't particularly like New York City, maybe because I don't know it, but I can never see myself living there. But London to me is a, you know, is a city of little villages almost, where I could easily see myself living there.
Well, I tell you, Greg, you know, it's just perspective. I mean, you really like England and London, but you know, New York's always been pretty much my home away from home. So
same here.
I don't know, but London's a great place. It's just not the same, you know.
Awkward silence. We don't do awkward silences.
Well, you know what? I wouldn't mind doing a pizza run to some of the best places in New York City. So if you ever want to do that, let me know.
All right, sounds like a plan.
You up for that, Mike?
Yes, let's do that, man. I miss some good places, man. There's some good ones. I mean, you know, in the village, there's Arturo's and John's offhand.
Oh, God, I remember going to John's, yeah.
Yeah, John's is supposed to be, well, from what I hear, it's supposed to be amazing.
Yeah.
And then there was another one in Soho, which is probably like the most famous, but the name escapes me, man. I don't know.
Oh, Original Ray's?
No, not Ray's, man. Oh, Lombardi's?
Yeah.
Lombardi's or Lombardo's or Lombardi's on Spring Street? I don't know if it was Spring Street.
You know what? That's the thing about New York. You can go to any pizzeria, pretty much any pizzeria in the city, and usually it's going to be freaking awesome, you know? And they're all just a little bit different, but they all taste great. Yeah. You know,
there was a place on University Place between 12th and 13th called Stromboli Pizza, which was, it wasn't that John's type pizza. I don't know the difference between the ovens, brick oven, coal oven, whatever.
Yeah.
But it was just, you know, pizza that you get in New Jersey at Angelo's, man. You know, it was flat pizza, just like your regular American type pizza, right? But they did something to the sauce. I don't know if they put sugar in it, man, whatever. It was a very like distinctive taste. And they finally closed, man. I was horrified to find that it was gone. Last time I was in a city. I haven't gotten in the city much, man, but I was there about a year ago to see an art exhibition at the Whitney. And I went over there and I was walking around the village and, it was gone, man. You know, I have to say though, man, everything, I don't want to say I'm over New York City because there's still a lot in New York City, man. And I still think it's, I mean, it's just like the museums alone, man. Cause you know, I love art. So, I mean, the Met is, it's Western civilization. It's Eastern. It's the whole world, man, in the Met. You know what I mean? You can go from ancient Rome to ancient Greece, and then the other side of the museum, you're in Egypt, man. And, you know, all of the Eastern art there, and African and Oceanic, man, and medieval stuff. You got the cloisters uptown. I'm a cinephile, so all of the movies that you don't see in New Jersey are playing there, you know.
Say that museum that you're describing sounds pretty cool. If you guys want to do a trip there one time, let me know. That sounds good.
It's crazy. Like, John, have you been there recently? Like the last.
Actually, I was there probably about a month ago. I went to Trash in Vaudeville to buy Beetle boots, and I was successful. And they're great, really freaking awesome, made in England. And it was nice being there. It's the same, but it's changed. It's not like it was, Mike. You know, I just had an uneasy feeling the whole time I'm there. Maybe I'm just getting older, haven't been there in a while.
I haven't been on St. Mark's Place in years, man, but yeah. I didn't even know it was still there.
No, it moved.
Oh,
it moved. Yeah, it's in a different location now. But, okay. You know, I used to go there all the time. I would go to, I'm trying to think of the name, that place where Harry met Sally. I'd go there for a hot dog. Cat's Deli. Yep. I don't know if you've ever been there, but
it's on like Houston and Second.
Yeah. Right by Alphabet City over there.
Yeah.
Great place. I like their food is really good there.
When you said it was like an uneasy feeling while you were there, man, I'll tell you what I didn't like about it when I was there the last time, man. And it was like ever since like the shutdowns, when the restaurants started going outside.
Yeah. Right,
and you combine that where you have all of these outdoor awning things where you can go and eat, right? So you're cutting into the street, right? I drive there. Right. I don't know about you, but I drive there.
And, yeah, I drive too.
In addition, you know, the addition of the bike lanes, which is fine, but they moved the bike lanes where the bike lanes used to be right off the curb. I mean, I'm sorry, the bike lanes used to be on the side of the cars, between the cars and the street traffic. Now they put the bike lanes right off the curb and you can park almost in the middle of the fucking street. You know what I'm talking about? Like they moved like cars parked in the middle of the street.
But here's the kicker, Mike.
And
here's the thing. Every time I've been to the city and they have the damn bike lanes on, like, let's say the left side of the road, on the right side where there's no bike lane, you see the guys riding the bikes in the car lane.
Yeah.
Nobody pays attention to that shit. It's such a waste of money and time.
These little concrete islands in the middle of the street. So if I'm turning, I'm on Charles, right? I'm on Charles, or maybe whatever the fuck street goes east, right? And I'm turning onto Hudson, right? I'm making a left onto Hudson. If you don't see that concrete island there, you're gonna fucking drive over it. You know, where they used to be, Hudson Street used to be three lanes. Now it's like one and a half. You know, and there's fucking graffiti everywhere, man. Like, you're starting to see graffiti everywhere. I'm predicting that there's going to be more graffiti in 5 years than there was in the entire fucking 70s, man.
Well, what about like 7th? What is it? 7th Avenue? That was tremendous. You would have, I mean, there were so many lanes. Now they got it all cut up.
Everything is
all screwed up. They destroyed the city.
I don't rush anymore, man. Now it's like stressful to just drive through it, man. And yeah. I get that. There was a time where I could have been a cab driver in New York, man. I would have fucking driven everywhere. Now it's a drag. You know, I had like one trip there last year and it was just like oh, fuck this. I couldn't wait to get back. I couldn't wait to get out.
My one suggestion to you, if you want to go into the city, the best time to go is on a Sunday because you don't have to worry about parking. So if you're going to drive in, Sunday's the day to go. But, yeah, it's not like it used to be. It's just, it's a pain in the ass to get around there.
Yeah. Well, I think every generation also says that too, man. You know, like every generation says, oh, the village isn't what it used to be and this and that. And now I catch myself saying that.
No, it's true. It's true. I mean, the stuff that we had, it's not there anymore.
I don't know if it was that there was, I think it was Reds, man, that Warren Beatty movie, Reds.
Uh-huh.
Where he plays John Reed, and it's basically like the village in the 1910s. And they're like, the village isn't what it used to be. You know?
Hey, he's right. It's not.
Oh, man. So, I don't know. So, I mean, is there anybody that... I know David Johansen. You asked me about David Johansen a while back, Greg. Is there anybody that you're really like trying to get, man, in terms of the rail tickets?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to get Johansen. It sounds strange that, you know, you're trying to get somebody American, you know, from New York to sign a rail ticket. But the Dolls had a really big influence over in England. You know, when they went over, you know, one of my favorite records of all time, you know, the Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bollocks. It could be in my top 10 of all, you know, recordings. I don't know if, I mean, the Dolls had an influence over there, you know, prior to the Pistols coming out. So I think he would be definitely worth trying to get on a rail ticket.
He would sign it too.
Yeah, that's good. You know, I will give you.
I'm not speaking for him, man, but I'm saying, like,
just, yeah, like, just
I think he would sign it, man.
Yeah, just don't let him listen to John theories.
So, what are you thinking about? Are you thinking about like this? Are you seriously considering doing this as a book project, man? Putting these into
I always find myself where I think I have really good ideas or ideas that could turn into something worthwhile, but that I never move forward with them. So being that we're both local to each other and you have experience of being a book writer, I do think that if we, you know, if you wanted to jump in on something like that, we could put, all right, you know, we could put the idea together and, you know, almost like a music artist writing a song and, you know, somebody hears it and puts the final touches of it, makes it happen. So, I think with.
And even if you can't, with my experience, which is very little, honestly, like to tell you the truth with the publishing industry, man, because. Somebody last night came up to me and he's like, went and got published, man. I said, no, I didn't get published. I published, because we're in the golden age right now, man, of self-publishing, of indie publishing, man. We're in the fucking golden age. It's right now. It's happening right now.
Well, you know what, Greg? I'm sorry to interrupt, but you know, you think about it. You got your rail tickets, right? Wouldn't that make a great coffee table book? Where you have the rail ticket, a picture of the rail ticket, and then you write a story about each one.
That's how I envision it.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether it be, you know, I'm thinking that you could do a fictional, you know, a fictional little blurb about it. But I think that if you could actually get that person who signed it to talk to you a little bit, or not even talk to you, just write a little bit, a blurb about their experience on the rail. Yeah, you're right. A coffee table book would work.
A coffee table book, or even the way you described it, Greg. There's a couple directions you could go with this. You know, we could talk more extensively about it off the podcast, you know, a different time. But no, there are different directions, because it's kind of like there's a lot of branches to this. It's not just like a, you know what I mean? You have a lot of options with the way you can present this thing.
You know, it's almost like if you were YouTubers and you had the influence and you had the connections where you can actually get somebody, you know, it would be amazing if you could get that person to ride a rail with you for 15 or 20 minutes and interview him on the rail.
Oh, that would be great. That would be awesome, man. I was going to say, man, I almost wish, like, you know, this podcast wasn't coming to an end soon, because, you know, I was going to say this is fun, man. We should do a live from the Liberty, but they're fucking going to be gone soon.
Yeah, that would be quite interesting.
Instead of just sitting at the bar, we'll set up shop in the corner under the TV, man, and, you know, start talking to random people.
John and I, it's funny. I don't know if we ever threw this idea over to you. You know, you have these cast of characters, people that do karaoke. And I don't know if you ever seen the one person, he's a short guy, wears a cowboy hat, sunglasses. He walks in there. He does a couple of songs. He has a big leather coat down to the floor. He's probably 5'3" and he has a leather coat that hangs down to the floor with sunglasses and a cowboy hat.
I'm sure
you look at somebody like that and you think, what goes through their mind prior, like during the day? What's their thought process about going to karaoke and singing at night, dressing up like that? Do they get in front of the mirror? Do they prep themselves to go out? Do they warm up? You know, is it, you know, what is the routine, like a day in the life of a karaoke singer like that? And there's a lot of people, like if you go to different karaoke places, you'll see a lot of characters. And these people are living, you know, their alter ego is coming out. You know, what makes them tick? I think that would kind of be a cool little TV show also.
Yeah, there are people in there. There are singers in there that you can attribute that to. Like everybody has their own little personality. Some people do dress up. I mean, I don't know. I would tend to think that, does he look like that everywhere he goes? Is a question to ponder.
I don't know, John, what's your thought of that
everywhere?
What's your read, John?
You know what? He has a YouTube channel and he's like one of these guys that, you know, talks about religion and stuff. So it's hard to get a beat on that guy. I'm trying to figure it out, but he seems like a nice enough guy. But he'll come in, he'll sing one song and he'll walk around the crowd and like just try to almost talk to everybody. And then he'll leave. You know what, Greg? Sometimes I see these people that sing karaoke and I say to myself, gee, I wonder what their story is. And sometimes, you know, I'll sit there with my friends and we'll make little stories up about people, like, oh, they're probably here because they got kicked out of their house, or, you know, they're here because they've got a crush on somebody that sings. So it's its own little microcosm of social knuckleheadedness. I mean, there are some really great singers and there are some people that are just like, you know, do you realize how you sound? You know, I mean, and it's, the thing is, if you take everything with a grain of salt, karaoke can be like a really fun experience. For me personally, it was a learning experience because I just needed to learn how to sing and develop my voice. And it took me a while. And you know what? I have a lot of fun doing it. I mean, as a musician, it's given me another outlet to express myself. And I think a lot of these people at the end of the day, they need to express themselves because they're working a 9-to-5 job. Nobody listens to them. Nobody looks at them. And then they get to karaoke and they're a star. Even if they have no talent, they're still a star because when they've got the mic, they're in control. So karaoke is a weird little microcosm. So
yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Hey, Mike,
you just nailed it, man. I think you just nailed it right there.
Yeah, I do too. But turning the table on you, Mike, you know, you as a guitar player, you have a very good voice. But you seem to rarely use it. So, you know, growing up, I think you could have taken the lead with your vocals. So, And interviewing you, Mike, what stopped you from ever taking the lead on vocals?
I never did, man. I was the lead singer in my own in bands. I sang lead for many years. In terms of karaoke, man, yeah, I did it for many years at the same place we go to, man. And I think coming out of, and I thought about this question, man. I thought about what's different now. I think coming out of the pandemic, man, and coming out of the shutdowns where nobody saw each other for a good year, right? Maybe some in some cases longer, and going back to that bar when they reopened and all of the negativity that was surrounding the reopening of that place, and a lot of the bullshit that was going on was a turnoff to me, man. And a lot of things were different. A lot of my friends didn't come back. A lot of personal relationships ended. I had falling outs with some people. So going back into that place was a completely different experience for me, man, where I had to like reacquaint myself with talking to people and meeting people and not having my comfort zone surrounding me, man. And when I'm not in my comfort zone, man, I tend to shut down. I close down, man. And that kind of stopped me from singing every week, you know, and just not, you know, where I was just, I would just rather sit there and observe like I did in the very beginning, you know, before I started even doing karaoke, you know? So, I mean, I think that's a long-winded answer to what I think was your question.
More so like, John, as a musician, has never stopped. Vocalists are a strange breed. They can be difficult, to say the least, to work with. So in the sense of John, he just said, screw it, I'm going to sing myself. And he taught himself how to sing. You were singing for years and a guitar player. So what it seems like you are more hesitant though to sing, where John is a lot more apt to sing because he's learning a new trade, you know, and did really well with it. But yeah, I guess you did answer, you know, why don't you do it more, or, you know, still use that that talent that you have?
I mean, it's developing, like John, like I use it also as exercise to develop my voice, and my voice has gotten better. I sing better now than I did 30 years ago, because 30 years ago, I really didn't know how to use my voice. I was a guitarist in a band, you know. As I got into my 30s, I was in a cover band and I would do a lot more lead vocals. And then I learned, I think through karaoke, I learned how to properly use my voice without taking any vocal lessons. I kind of just those methods of singing, and maybe John could help me elaborate a little bit, because he probably knows, you know, like those methods of singing that vocal coaches use, and those things kind of found me. I don't know if I found them or much more as much as they found me, where, you know, breathing techniques and hitting notes that you could never do at one point, right? And do you find yourself like singing songs that you never imagined you could sing like 5 years ago? You're like, I can't fucking do that, you know? And now you're able to do it. And you're like, well, how did I get here? How could I reach these notes that I, you know, attempting 5 years ago, I couldn't even breathe?
I tell you, Mike, to your point, it's just a matter of practice. I mean, and doing it, but you really have to do it properly or you'll hurt yourself. Yeah. I took some vocal lessons, and a couple of things that I learned. Number one is I always warm up. You can't really, I used to think, oh, okay, I can warm up on the first or second song. But you can't do that. You have to go through a certain string of events to really to get your voice up to par, to get everything moving the way it's supposed to. And then once you do that, it's also breathing. If you're not breathing properly and you don't have the wind, you'll start singing flat. You'll flatten out on a note. Another thing is rest. If you're not rested and you don't and you're like fatigued, your voice will get fatigued. So you're being a singer is like being an athlete. You know, you have your instrument and it's in your throat, and you have to treat it that way. You can't take your throat for granted. You don't abuse it. When you're out in the cold, you wear a scarf. You don't drink excessively, and it's like a whole routine. You know, you're an athlete. I mean, even if you're singing in a bar, or even doing karaoke, because the bottom line is, you know, people are listening to you, and you know, I always want to be my best. So I'm a pretty competitive guy, and if I'm not at my best, I'm not going to be out there. So if you hear me sing, you know that I've rehearsed, that I've warmed up. And I'm confident that I could sing the song.
Yeah, that's a big part of it too. You know, a lot of people, there's that element of karaoke where people do it for fun, you know, and there's the people that we, you know, we've talked about that don't necessarily have good voices. Some of them have good voices, but no sense of key or, you know, but I won't do something for fun. I won't do it unless I know I can nail it. You know, and then maybe I don't know if that's a competitive thing in me, but, or if it's just, I don't want to get up there and bomb. You know, I think we just lost John. Did we lose John?
I just heard a beep.
Yeah. John's camera went off. John, can you hear us? All right. I don't know if we lost John, but we seem to have lost John at some point, but,
See if it pops back in, but
yeah.
Something you just said, they have good singing voice, but they have no sense of key.
Yeah.
It's something I've never understood.
Remember, Greg, we're recording, so don't name names.
Yeah, no, it's something I never understood. That if you're no sense of key, how is, I can't see how that is possible. How can you not hear key? You know, how can you not hear if you're off key or in key?
Tone deaf. I think tone deaf is a real thing. You know?
Yeah.
I just think it's a real thing. It's something that, it's not just like, oh, this person's tone deaf. I think it's like where you sound good to yourself, but you can't hear what you sound like. To every, you know, what it sounds like to everybody else.
Yeah, it's a strange phenomenon. I don't want to call it a phenomenon, but to me, it's just strange. If
you have no sense of key, like if you have no musical, like I don't want to say background, but if you have no knowledge of theory or notes, or you know, you're not gonna hear it. I don't know. I can't.
Yeah, you know, it. You're right. Maybe because, you know, we've all grown up musically. It's something we can't understand. Years ago, I would be able to sing. Today, I can't. I can't hold a note, but I can hear it. I would never do it because I can hear it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It's a mystery to me.
Yeah.
I can sing. But I don't necessarily look to sing, but whatever, man.
Yeah.
I'm looking.
Yeah, it looks like John.
Man, it's like John is MIA, but I'm looking at all these. While we're here, I'm wondering what all these little apps are here on the side of my Zoom screen. Can you see the arrow that I'm?
No, nothing at all.
All right. Yeah, nice. I have to look into this, man. I have to see what this is all about. My screen looks a little bit different. Anyway, so yeah, this was fun, man. I wish we didn't lose John. I don't know where he went. He's floating out in cyberspace somewhere. But I guess wrapping up, you know, I like I said, I wish this podcast of mine wasn't coming to an end, because it took us forever to do this, because we've been talking about doing this episode for like well over a year now. And then we didn't really start seriously talking about it till October. Okay, John's back. Let me let him in.
All right.
All right, well, wait. He's connecting. And I'll just hold off on my, you know, I'll just delay this for a second. It looks like John, he was here.
Yeah, he's trying. No,
he's trying. Okay, yeah, he's trying to get back in. His name is there.
John, you there?
It's like Carol Ann in Poltergeist, man. It's just like she's like stuck inside the TV, man. Carol Ann.
Yeah, but I must say, Mike, this has been an extremely cool experience. And, you know, doing this, I know it's only audio, but you know, I think that if you take it in another, you know, you're ending this idea of your podcast, but I think you should consider possibly looking into, you know, if you're in one era is ending, start another one, you know, different direction, you know.
What the problem with the podcast is, and I love doing it. What I don't like about it is it's very time consuming. And like when this is finished, I'm going to run it through recording software. I'm going to convert it to an MP3. And, you know, not necessarily this one, but some podcasts are a nightmare to edit and mix the sound. Like this one, I'm not really going to do any editing. You know, there's just, our conversation is going to be out there. It's going to be released in like a day or two. It's going to be out there. You'll be able to listen to it. But I spent a lot of time, man, you know, planning it and preparing interviews. And from the outset, man, I had some pretty good help and support during the first season or two. And then I lost one of my co-hosts, and then my other co-host just kind of bailed on me like two seasons ago too. But he's got a lot, you know, to his defense, he's got a lot going on in his personal life, man. So I'm kind of left to fend for myself here, you know, and it becomes no fun when you're doing everything yourself. And there's also that big monster called my books, because I'm writing two books. I managed to get out two books in the last 2 years during the shutdowns, but I'm still writing a massive book project that's going to hopefully be out in 2024. And I'm editing one that's coming out in the summer right now as we speak. So the podcast, man, at this point I think it's reached as far as it'll take me. And there's just no joy in it anymore, man. I enjoy this.
Yeah.
But the nightmare is when we're done and I have to start converting it and getting it out there into the world, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking more on the side of, you know, the Zoom thing where you have different, you know, you have all different faces and different people in different boxes each week or each month. You know, it's almost kind of cool and exciting. I didn't know what to expect.
Well, this is the way it's done, man. You know, and I admire those podcasts that, like you said, the boxes where you can see everybody's face.
Yeah.
And I've always been camera shy. I'm still camera shy, man. You know, I'm never comfortable looking at myself in pictures, let alone video, man. And I'm one of those people that get critical. Oh, look at my hair. Look at my crooked teeth. Look at this. Look at that, you know? And, you know, once your image is out there, man, people can do whatever the fuck they want with it.
Yeah, you know? True.
So with that, I see John's name, man. I would love, I really want him to be here for as we wrap up, but we're looking at
there he is
just as we're saying goodbye and wrapping up. Carol Ann, are you out there? Carol Ann, what did they do with you, Carol Ann?
Johnny, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you guys.
Johnny, can you hear me?
Listen, Mike, it's been a pleasure.
It's been fun, man. We've been talking, been wrapping up, and we see that you've been abducted like Carol Ann in Poltergeist. You've disappeared, but you're back.
What happened? My phone ran out of battery.
Oh, okay.
And now I switched to the
computer. That'll do it.
Yeah, because I was going to say the voice sounds a little bit different.
Can you hear my radio voice now?
Yes, I can.
We're going to call Zelda Rubinstein to come in and take you out of the television. Back into your bedroom.
I thought he was falling asleep on us, so I thought maybe he just crashed.
We were wrapping up and talking about the horrors of podcasting, but you know how fun this was, nonetheless.
Yeah, John, I was trying to convince him to look at a different avenue down the road.
Down the road, yeah, man. Like I said, I have multiple things. I have multiple things happening right now, and I can't wait to wrap this up. I'm going to wrap it up at the 100th episode. Me and Pat talked about this a while back. We're like, we should just do 100 episodes and just stop. Just leave it at that. And that's exactly what we've turned out to do, you know?
Well, but yeah. Mike, it's one of those things where if you think it's run its course, then do something new.
Run its course, man. There's no more joy in it, man. Like I said, this is fun, but after this, like getting it out into the world is going to, you know, it takes quite a bit of work. Not this, man. I'm not going to edit this one really that much at all, except for the beginning, man. But there are nightmare podcasts to edit sometimes, you know? Yeah. And it's very time consuming, man. And I just don't have it in me anymore. Like some future project, man, where like I do this other, like I do a Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons podcast with, some friends in the UK, speaking of the UK, Manchester and, Madrid in Spain. And some guys in one guy's on the West Coast and a couple of guys are in Jersey, but all I have to do is show up, you know, I don't have to deal with it. Once I sign off, I don't have to deal with it. You know, and maybe one day at some point, or I'll gladly take part in somebody else's, but you know, somebody else has got to be in the driver's seat, you know.
All right, man. But anyway, well, I look maybe forward Greg. To projects.
Yeah, we'll talk more about your book, man. I'll see you at the watering hole.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hope to see you there, John.
It was fun, guys.
Gentlemen, it was a pleasure.
I was glad you were able to join us, man, John, because we were like, can we get John? Let me talk to John. And I was like, let me know. So I got to get your number, man. Give him my number.
You got it. I'll tell you know,
because I have no way. I never have any way of reaching John.
All right.
Okay, man. Sounds like a deal.
All right, guys. So I'll see you up the road, man. I'll be there. I'll be at the watering hole on Friday because there's a band playing. And
that's right. Yes.
Is it an old band, Mike?
It's my old band. Me and the bass player started it in 1998. So it's actually their 25th anniversary. And, you know, maybe a farewell show to this place that we're that we're talking about.
Yeah, I think it is a farewell show, and I forgot all about it. So hopefully
I may end up being there Friday and Saturday.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know about Saturday, but I definitely have to go there Friday, man. You know.
All right. Well, I'll catch up with you then.
Yeah, that'll be a fun time, man. It'll be and Sharon's coming out. Sharon and Ray are coming out definitely for that.
All right. And, yeah, I'm sure.
Probably like just their whole crowd. I mean, it's going to be crazy. I'm really predicting the biggest crowd we've seen in that place. It's going to be nuts, man. I think. I hope not, but.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
All right, guys.
All right.
Mikey. Ciao.